I want to do a kind of running commentary on the book of Galatians, partly because this is another document somewhat like Niebuhr and Hauerwas that's very hard for some of you to get into. Let me start by drawing an initial diagram that I think will give us some help in understanding the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. The usual way that we structure or think about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism is that you have Judaism here, let's say going back to Abraham, and then the Exodus and the exile, and here is the time of Christ, and then here you have the beginning of a new religion, Christianity, and this is Judaism. There are some connections, but it's a kind of straight line with Christianity from the time of Jesus on being a new religion. I want to suggest a way that I think is historically more accurate of drawing these connections, and that is that you have the same timeline with Abraham, Exodus, exile. See if I can find another pen here that's a little finer. Here we are. And then a very interesting thing happens historically. After the time of the exile, Judaism begins to branch out into a number of different forms. You have, for instance, one party, relatively small, the Sadducees. You have the Essenes, the people of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You have the Zealots, a fairly activist political party as much as anything. And then you have the, let's put the, up on top, let me put the Pharisees here. It'll, oh, my pen just ran. Let's make this the Pharisees. And here are the Sadducees. Okay, and these different forms of Judaism, different things happen. At 70 AD, you have the war with Rome, and the Essenes and the Zealots are fairly well stamped out at that point. They suffer great defeat, although there's some continuing activity from the Essenes, but not a lot. The Sadducees, there's some continuation till about AD 135. And the Pharisees continue on indefinitely and are the origin of modern rabbinic Judaism. That is, the other forms of Judaism, the Essenes, the Zealots, the Sadducees, pretty well cease being a significant historical force. But something else happens during this time. If you take this as the crucifixion of Jesus, you have another form of Judaism that to some extent draws on all of these, but particularly draws on Pharisaic Judaism and, I would say, some of the thinking of the Essenes, not so much the Zealots and the Sadducees, but drawing particularly from the Pharisees and the Essenes, you have what I would call the origin of Christian Judaism, which gradually then shifts into what we think of as Christianity. Now, let me tell you why I want to diagram it this way, is because all of the earliest Christians were Jews and thought of themselves as Jews. They did not think of themselves as starting a new religion. They thought of themselves as reinterpreting their own faith, which was Judaism. And it was not till the latter part of the first century, from the middle of the first century on towards the end, that there was more and more Greek influence within Jewish Christianity. And so somewhere during that period, it comes to be more and more thought of as a very distinct religion. This is one reason, incidentally, why some of the passages in the New Testament, this would particularly be true of the writings of Paul and to some extent of the Gospels, where you find strong criticism of Jews, cannot easily be construed as anti-Semitic in the modern sense of anti-Semitism. They are far sooner family quarrels of people within Judaism arguing with each other about the true nature of the faith. And I mention this because it's very difficult to understand what's going on in the book of Galatians if you think of Christianity as a totally new religion. Galatians now represents some of the first controversy of Jewish Christianity encountering non-Jews, and the question arises, how do they live together? How do they redefine the faith that makes sense to all of them? I'm sorry for the sloppiness of that diagram. I'll work out a better one next time. But the point is very important for understanding what's happening both in Judaism and in the history of the early church. Now, why focus on the book of Galatians? The theory that I'm working with in this course, right from the beginning, is that ethics is not just a matter of rules and principles, but a matter of how we view the world. And I've been particularly fascinated with the idea that grows up in Judaism, in Israelite religion, that the indicative precedes the imperative, that God's grace, mercy, deliverance precedes the demands of the law. And I argue that that puts ethics in a very different framework from what happens if you see ethics as primary and as the means by which one becomes a good person. Ethics, in this way of thinking, is more how a person with a right understanding of the nature of the world and herself, how she lives out her life in terms of those realities. And to a considerable extent, ethics within this view represents something like what we might call those wise restraints which make men free. That is, that ethics represents a kind of set of guidelines and possibilities of how someone would live out their lives within these realities. Jim, how have you done? Shall we? Okay, let me give you these right now. Nothing available Thursday. Okay, let's... Monday, Jim, could you check this for us, too? We decided to Monday to go from at 8 a.m., and I'll do that one. You don't have to do it. Check if Furno's available then. Friday, we're going to have from 1:25 to 2:15. Friday, 1:25 to 2:15. And, Jim, can you see if... Could you find... And Monday at 8, could you find anything for Thursday? I mean, not Inferno or from Sandy? Nothing. Ah, this new system kills us. Okay, then we're going to have to go with the Friday date and Monday at 8. I'm very, very sorry about this. I'm not used to this new system yet, because in past years we always were able to scare up something in our building. We'll come back to this. Okay, the... this is Inferno 304, the one we have set, Friday 1:25 to 2:15, Inferno 304. Let's assume it's going to be Inferno 304, but Jim is checking. Yes. The problem we have with that is building security and so on. All over the campus, we've had these ominous memos coming to us. Computers and stuff are being stolen. And it is really hard to have evening meetings in some buildings. Let me think about that as the class goes on, and I'll see. That might be another possibility. Okay. Sorry, I've got to get my mind back. Yes, was there another comment? No. Okay. The assumption, then, that I work with is that this relationship between indicative and imperative is very fundamental for at least one way of understanding ethics. The implications of this for the environment are that something roughly like environmental education is probably in the long run more important than environmental ethics in a strict sense. That is, the first task is to help children come to respect and love nature, come to understand themselves in such a way that they will be motivated to work for a better treatment of nature. Now, the reason we're looking at Galatians is I think Galatians represents, in a quintessential sense, the Christian understanding of this same kind of relationship between indicative and imperative. That is, that the indicative precedes the imperative, that gospel precedes law. And I'd like to try to unpack that in a way that would make some sense to you. The other reason, just in passing, to focus on Galatians and on one of the letters of St. Paul is that probably there are no writings in our cultural background that are more influential than the passages we've looked at from Deuteronomy and Exodus and the Pentateuch in general, the Torah, and secondly, the two writings of Romans and Galatians in the New Testament along with the Gospels. These are some of the germinal writings of Western culture along with some of the Socratic dialogues and so on, and I think it's just part of a general education to take a close look at them. Now, Galatians was written by Paul, who was a Jew who had converted to Christianity. He was known as Saul of Tarsus. He had a dramatic conversion experience on the road to Damascus. He had been a persecutor of the church and now became one of its staunchest defenders. His letters to Romans and Galatians are two of his most influential. And the letter to the Galatians was written to a church or group of churches located in Asia Minor, that is roughly what is modern-day Turkey, written towards the middle of the first century. There's some controversy about the exact date. The authorship of some of the Pauline epistles, particularly 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, has been disputed, but there's little doubt that he wrote Galatians and Romans and probably at least 1st and 2nd Corinthians. And what I want to do this morning is to try to shed some light on the nature of the epistle. Not just in a text-critical, historical sense, but I'd like to try to get at the underlying themes that I see in the epistle itself. We have the standard introduction in the first chapter, verses 1 through 5. These are almost like formulas that appear in writings of this type at that time. Paul's writing to these churches, he refers to himself as an apostle of Jesus Christ and so on. But then very quickly, much more quickly than in most of his letters, he gets right into the controversy he faces. In chapter 1, verse 6, he says, "I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and turning to a different gospel." Jim, what did you find? Ferno 2:10. Okay, let's run this then for the last time. Ferno 2:10 today, 4:30. Friday, what did we say? 1:15 was that, Jim? 1:25 in Ferno 3:04. And Monday, 8 a.m. in Ferno 3:04. Have you got those all down, Jim, exactly? Today at 1:25. Today at 4. 4:30. Got it. Sorry. Friday at 1:25 and Monday at 8. And the one today is Inferno 2:10. The other's Inferno 3:04. We got it? I really apologize for such a sloppy way of doing this, but I'll get used to the system. Okay, we get a clue then from 1:6 that Paul is rather disturbed because this is much stronger language as it is throughout the epistle. In verse 8, he says, but even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to that which we preach to you, let him be accursed. That's extremely strong language, even for those days. And in those days, people used much stronger language than today. They had no hesitation in calling each other. Jews sometimes referred to Gentile dogs, and Gentiles were very unflattering towards Jews and towards each other. People spoke rather bluntly. And I think that's important to realize, lest you read more into some of these controversies than is actually there. There wasn't a kind of political language that was polished in the way that we have become somewhat more used to it today, although after hearing the Zhirinovsky in the Soviet Union, I'm not so sure in Russia things change today too. Anyway, Paul is very exercised by what is happening. Just in brief, the conflict is this. Jewish Christians, that is, Jews who had followed Jesus, continued to keep the Judaic law. They continued to keep Torah. They continued to keep the various regulations regarding food and washing of hands and many, many such rules about how to live. The question arose when Gentiles, that is, non-Jews, became Christians, should they also have to follow the Jewish law? Because there's a problem here. When you're eating together, when you're living in close association together, if some are keeping all of these regulations and some are not, there's a genuine problem. How do you solve this? And what seems to have been the case is that Paul and Peter, this is St. Peter, who's here referred to as Cephas, that's C-E-P-H-A-S. That equals Peter. It's another name for St. Peter. They apparently had reached a kind of agreement that the new converts from the Gentile world would not have to keep the Jewish ritual law. Then apparently what happened is some of the more conservative Christian Jews from Jerusalem came up to Antioch and started arguing and said, no, these new converts ought also to keep the Jewish law and regulations. And Peter went along with that. That is, he changed his mind. He now went along with that argument that they too ought to keep the Jewish law. And Paul is very, very upset about this. And what I want to try to make clear is why this seemed like such a big deal to Paul, why he writes an entire epistle dealing with this. Just a few words of terminology, and then we'll get right into the heart of the argument. When Paul refers to the term flesh, you are no longer in the flesh and the works of the flesh and so on, this is a difficult term to get a hold of in the epistle because sometimes the term sarx in Greek, the term flesh, sometimes has the meaning of body in a fairly straightforward sense. Sarx equals body. And sometimes it has the meaning of the old nature, or what some of the older translations call the old man, or the unredeemed person. So when Paul speaks of the works of the flesh, he is not speaking mainly of the body. A little later, he speaks of the works of the flesh as including immorality, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, selfishness, and so on. And obviously, these are not just sensual sins. They involve sins of the mind, and so on. So that what Paul is referring to in those passages is not just the body, not just sexuality, more specifically, but he's referring to what might roughly be called the old nature. And that's fairly important for understanding some of these arguments. Otherwise, it looks like a kind of simple mind-body dualism that I think distorts the letter because that's so foreign to the Jewish background of St. Paul. In chapter 3, which I think you can skip over lightly, there's a reference back to Abraham. And you have here a typical rabbinic argument of the day. It doesn't make a lot of sense to those of us who aren't used to that way of arguing. But here, I would again urge you, when you read a text like this, try to get inside the text to where the people were at that time. This would have been an argument, I think, that would have been fairly persuasive to many of his listeners, even though, starting with different assumptions, it's not necessarily convincing to us today. Now, I want to focus particularly on chapter 5. I think the heart of his argument is in chapter 5, where he starts out, "For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand fast, therefore, and do not submit again to the yoke of slavery." And then he says something very strong again. He says, "Now I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you." Now, circumcision here, in a way, is symbolic of the whole issue. The question was, should the Gentile converts be circumcised as Jews were? And the more conservative Jewish Christians from Jerusalem were saying yes. Paul says loudly and clearly no. And he says, "I say to you that if you," that is the Gentile converts, "receive circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is bound to keep the whole law. You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law. You have fallen away from grace." Now, what is Paul talking about? That's a very strange argument to most of you. Let me try to unpack that. What Paul is arguing here is that the heart of the new faith is that gospel precedes law, that the indicative precedes the imperative, that people, whether Jews or Gentiles originally, receive salvation not through doing the works of the law, that is, not through following the moral, ethical, ritual standards of Judaism or of any other culture. They receive salvation, which is the central term here, not by being good or moral or keeping the works of the law, but as a gift from God, in this case, not through the Exodus experience as for Jews, but through the life and death and resurrection of Jesus and identification with that historical reality. Paul is saying basically that salvation is a gift based on God's righteousness, his goodness, just as deliverance from Egypt for the Jews was a gift, and God did not choose Jews because they were the best of all people, and so on. Paul's key sentence here in Romans is, "While you were yet sinners, Christ died for you. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us." And what he's arguing then is, if now you want to also keep the works of the law, and notably circumcision, if you insist that these Gentiles be circumcised as a part of the basic reality of being a Christian, you are undercutting this principle of radical grace and love and the fact that salvation is a gift rather than something you earn. So that to insist on the Gentiles being circumcised is to say that salvation really isn't a gift ultimately. It's a reward for keeping the law, for being a good person in the eyes of God. And what Paul says, if this happens, you've fallen away from grace. That you either accept the principle that ultimately this is God's gift, or you accept the principle that you need to justify yourself. And it doesn't work to have part one and part the other. Paul sees that as undercutting the radical quality of the Christian message. Now, this also explains why it was perfectly permissible and agreeable to Paul that Jewish Christians continued to keep the law. Because for them, this was simply the way culturally they had been raised. So he had no problem with Jewish Christians, and including himself, keeping the law by and large. That is, if they wanted to continue to go through the rituals of washing and things about eating and how they conducted their lives, that was fine, because that for them did not represent a compromise of the basic principle. And then he says in verse 6 of chapter 5, he says, "For in Christ neither circumcision nor uncircumcision is of any avail, but faith working through love." That could be translated, neither keeping the law nor not keeping the law is ultimately important. What is ultimately important is the grace of God, that life fundamentally is not something you earn where you need to justify yourself and prove your own worth. It is a gift. Now, that is a very, very radical idea. I think it's the same fundamental idea that we see in Judaism in the Exodus. And Paul wants to preserve this core of what he sees the new faith as. And in a way, this is a discussion not altogether foreign to Judaism itself, where the issue came up from time to time, what is the relationship between God's righteousness and so on, and the keeping of the law? What does it mean to really be a Jew? Do you become a Jew by keeping Torah, or do you keep Torah because you are a Jew? That's the fundamental issue that's at stake here, is what is the basis of this new life as a Christian? And then Paul concludes this discussion in verse 13. He says, "For you were called to freedom. Brethren, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh," that is the old nature, "but through love be servants of one another, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." So what he's suggesting here is that there is a new kind of freedom for the Christian, but it is not a freedom to selfishness and self-centered behavior. It's a freedom to be a servant, to serve others rather than yourself. And we have in this letter a fascinating passage that I skipped by earlier, in chapter 2, verses 20 through 21, that reminds us in some ways very closely of the Niebuhr writing and of the things that Iris Murdoch was emphasizing. Paul says, "I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me." Notice the dialectic. I have been crucified. Recall Iris Murdoch's unselfing. Recall Niebuhr's the shattering of the self. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. But notice then that this is not a kind of utter destruction of the self, because paradoxically he goes on immediately and says, "and the life I now live," which sounds very odd indeed, because if he's been crucified with Christ, how can he now continue to live? What he's talking about here is there's been a kind of unselfing, a kind of shattering of the self. The old nature has died, and there is a new nature that is essentially the life of God within him. And this is a movement, I would suggest, that is found in many, many kinds of religious experience. There's an old situation that has become flawed, whether it's the self or in Marxism, the domination of capital and the capital owners, whether in the Enlightenment, ignorance and superstition. There is a new situation, whether it's the classless society, whether it's the kingdom of God in Judaism or Christianity, whether it's a society that is educated and based on science and reason, and then there's a way to get there. Remember I talked about the tripartite way of thinking about religion. You see it here very, very clearly. I have been crucified with Christ, and yet the life I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God. An old way, a new way, and the new way is the way of freedom. Now, I wish we had more time to get into some of this. In chapter 6, Paul talks about responsibility for one another and responsibility for oneself. He has a summary verse in chapter 6:15 where he writes, "For neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but a new creation." Again, neither keeping the law nor breaking the law, not keeping it, ultimately is important. The important thing is the question of a new creation. I emphasize that because I think it is easy to pull away from legalism by becoming a kind of nonconformist. But we often overlook the fact that if you make a life habit out of being nonconformist, you are just as much bound by the nonconformity as you were by the conformity. That is, if you spend a lot of energy breaking the law, snubbing society, living as a free spirit, and if that becomes your goal, you're just as much tied into that as you were previously tied into a kind of legalistic attitude towards a moral code. This came home to me very forcefully when I was a graduate student at Harvard. I had just about finished up my doctoral thesis back in the summer of 64, and I had about 3 months' work left, and I got to Cambridge that summer. I was already teaching at Earlham College, and things went along fine for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then I had this experience of a kind of psychological freeze-up, and I found I wasn't writing. I wasn't getting anything done, and that didn't worry me too much for the first day or two or three because that had happened before. By the end of the first week, I was getting a little worried. By the end of the second week, I was very worried. By the end of the third week, I was panicked because I literally wasn't writing at all. I'd go every morning to the Andover Harvard Library and start to write, and I just wouldn't produce anything. A real blockage psychologically. And I really got worried because keeping my job partly depended on having the degree in hand. And it looked more and more, especially after 4 and 5 weeks, that I just wasn't going to make it. This went on for the better part of 2 months, and I was almost a basket case by that time. And then I remember very distinctly one day, sitting in the library, and as a kind of almost inner revelation, I began to realize that the Harvard PhD had become the most important thing in my life. It had become more important than my wife, family, anything. I wanted that PhD, period. In a literal sense, it had become my God. More important than anything else. And I sat there at the desk as this kind of insight began to dawn. And then it really hit. And all of a sudden, I just banged my fist down on the table. and said to, I think some of my friends on either side thought I had finally snapped because they knew I was having troubles. And I said, I'll be damned if I'll let Harvard do this to me. And then I suddenly realized, no, it wasn't Harvard doing it to me, at least not for the most part. It was my letting Harvard and all of its standards and so on do this to me and my attitude towards them. And I had this sense of enormous liberation. And my first thought was after that to clear out. Oh, isn't it wonderful to be free of this tyranny. And I was all set to pack up and told my wife, we're heading out of here. Forget the PhD. I'm just not going to do this. And she wisely didn't say much right then. She listened. And then the next day, I happened to open up the book of Galatians to this passage and read, for neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but a new creation. And I suddenly realized in a second moment of insight that if I went through the rest of my life hating Harvard and fighting Harvard and putting down this hugely competitive system, and it was an awful system in some ways. In the philosophy department, they routinely at that time admitted about 15 students a year and routinely never graduated more than about five. They washed out two out of three of some of the brightest young men and women in the country. It wasn't the greatest system at that time. But I realized that if I spent the rest of my life fighting this system, I would be just as much bound by it if I spent the rest of my life serving it. And then I realized that I needed the PhD as a kind of union card if I wanted to continue teaching, which I very much wanted to, and that it made a lot of sense to finish it. Neither serving Harvard nor fighting Harvard is the ultimate issue, but a new attitude towards the whole situation. It was too late that summer to finish it up, but the next summer I came back and very quickly, in a matter of a month or so, finished up the thesis, and that was the end of it. But I think that nicely illustrates what Paul is talking about, and part of why I think the letter of Galatians is so interesting, that Paul is basically saying, if you go through life constantly trying to justify yourself, to prove your own worth, to prove to yourself or to others or to God or to whomever that I am a worthwhile good person, life is not going to be a lot of fun, and you're constantly going to be trapped because you never will be able to get enough money or power or status or fame to really do the job if you're basically insecure inside. And that what Paul is saying here is that security at this deepest level is another kind of matter. Let me try to sum that up very briefly because we're running out of time. When he says in 5:14, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And I would ask this question, and this is a kind of free attempt to get at the essence of the epistle. I would ask this question, how is one indeed able to love his or her neighbor? Let me try to respond to that in a way that I think unpacks what Paul is saying. I draw this from the late Swiss theologian Emil Brunner, B-R-U-N-N-E-R, who makes three basic points in answer to this important question, how indeed are we able to love our neighbor? And he says in the first place that you cannot love your neighbor if you yourself have not been loved. I think of an illustration that a professor of mine at Harvard gave, Hans Hoffmann. He worked for UNESCO after World War II and encountered many of the orphans that had been made orphans during the war, had lost their parents. And he describes this one situation in Paris where they had this one highly withdrawn child, in a pleasant room with lots of toys, and they sat behind a curtain and observed the child, couldn't be seen. And the child just sat there with these wonderful toys, never reached out a finger to one of them for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, a half an hour, just sat there immobilized. Finally, they went back and took the child away. And Hoffman said, you know, it's very easy to understand what happened. This child lost his parents when he was just a year or so old. He had been pushed around from one situation to the other. Often when he had reached out for something, someone had slapped him, pushed him away, rebuffed him. And he learned that the safest way to relate to the world about him was to be as withdrawn as possible. At least he wouldn't get hit if he didn't reach out for things, perhaps the wrong things. Hoffman says in the second, and I think that's fairly easy for all of us to understand. Some of us who grew up in a home where there was lots of demands and little love, lots of criticism and not much acceptance, we know that that leaves a kind of indelible sense of insecurity that lasts throughout much of our life unless we find creative ways of dealing with it. And it makes it very hard for us to be generous and outgoing and concerned about the interests and needs of other people. Brunner says, secondly, you cannot love your neighbor yesterday or tomorrow, but only today. You can't love your neighbor yesterday because yesterday is past. That's clear. You can't love your neighbor tomorrow because none of us really knows whether we will ever have a tomorrow. We are finite. We are insecure. The problem is we can only love our neighbor today, but many of us don't really have a today. Many of us find it very difficult to live in the present moment. Notice when I came in this morning, I was distracted by 100 different things, and it took a lot of energy to somehow get into the present moment because I was worried about all of these other things. If we're worried about that lousy stock investment we made that's running us into the ground, or if we're worried about what may happen to an important relationship, or if we're worried about how badly we treated someone and we feel guilty and remorseful about it, all of these things rob us of the present moment. And that's why it's so often the case, and I'm sure some of you have noticed this sometimes when you come in to see me in my office, sometimes I'm really there, but sometimes I'm not really there. I'm sort of going through the motions because part of me is somewhere else worried or anxious or feeling guilty, whatever. And Brunner says you can't love your neighbor yesterday or tomorrow, but only today. Then the problem is, how do you have a today? How can we really be present with one another where we are? And finally, he says, you cannot love your neighbor unless you yourself are free from the compulsive need to justify yourself and your own actions, unless you are free from the need to prove the value of your own life. One of the first things they tell students in various counseling and therapy programs where they're learning to be therapists is you have to give up the need to be helpful. Because if what really is driving you is the need to be a helper and to be successful, you're not going to be very successful in counseling people. And I think we see all the time that much of what passes for concern or love for others or social concern is a rather compulsive attempt to make ourselves look better. I think we've all encountered the do-gooder type who wants to help, but we quickly get the sense that he or she is far less interested in really helping than in making himself look good as a helper. The person who comes in with answers and solutions and doesn't ever take the time to listen to where you really are. Now, what Brunner is saying is that in all of these cases, who you are, your being precedes your doing. And I think this is what Niebuhr and Paul and many others are saying, is that it is only as you yourself find a way to deal with the radical insecurity of human existence, the anxiety that this produces, only as you find a way to deal with this creatively will you yourself be free to really serve and love and care for others, and I think ultimately also to care for the world about us, the world of nature. That if our essential focus is upon ourself and our self-interests and proving ourselves and establishing our own worth and security, there isn't a lot of energy left over to really care about others. And that's why it seems to me that it's so utterly fascinating, both in Judaism and in Christianity, that there is this fundamental insight that the indicative precedes the imperative, that gospel precedes law, that God's love precedes human response, so that ethics then is not this very fancy set of rules and regulations which, if you follow, you become a good person. Ethics is realizing the true nature of the world in which you live, and then in a kind of almost spontaneous, free, thankful, grateful way, relating to others and the world about you. And ethics, in the narrower sense, then becomes the guidelines, so you can share in what others have learned in making this more nearly possible. Ethics is the statement of freedom. It's not, first of all, the statement of bondage. And at least it seems to me that we ought to think about this as another possibility of how to construe the moral life. That being precedes doing. How you see the world precedes how you act. Freedom is not just making a lot of choices, but to some degree is precisely not having to make a lot of choices. I'm a little frustrated because I had to omit part of the lecture because of the mix-up on the time, but I think I've at least made some start in getting across the idea. My point here is not to convert you to St. Paul's way of thinking, but to get you to have some feeling for the power of that way of thinking, whatever your ultimate attitude towards it is. And I think to some extent, it's an idea that can be translated into other contexts in a very exciting way of thinking about the nature of ethics. Okay, you have your exams. They're due in class at the beginning of a class on Tuesday, and then Tuesday we'll have the mini-essay part of the examination. And again, we have the, for those of you who came late, we have three review sessions. Jim, would you read those times to me? Ah, here they are. Today at 1:25. No, today at 4:30, sorry, in room 210 Furno. Thursday, 4:30, 210 Furno. Friday, 1:25 and 304 Furno. And Monday at 8 a.m. in 304 Furno. Thank you.